Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Back. Today on the show, we'll look at an effort to reduce the numbers of people going to prison.
So Wyoming's prison population is projected to grow by about 200 people in the next 5 years. It's currently operating at full capacity.
A story on what degree the Hathaway Scholarship is actually increasing access to higher education in Wyoming.
With me, it was no path, so I kind of had to pave my own.
A new kind of toilet may be coming to a national park near you, but be prepared for something different.
There's a bit of stigma around it. You know, I think that although it's popular in many other countries in the Western world, it doesn't appear to be popular.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming lawmakers are sticking by President Trump as he escalates his global trade war, even as fear is growing that it'll soon be felt from the state's oil fields all the way down to the electronics you rely on. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that other Republicans from across the nation are not as patient as our lawmakers.
Wyoming oil and gas companies are already facing a labor shortage. But now those companies may soon get hit with another sucker punch, the increased cost of buying the steel they rely on every day. Steel is used in everything from the equipment used to drill wells to the pipes used to carry that black gold and natural gas to market. As those costs of doing business go up, it will either mean fewer jobs or you'll be paying more money at the pump. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says she's hearing about it, but she's being patient for now.
We've got to wait and see. I think that it's the one area, you know, I've just met with some Chamber of Commerce folks this morning, and the economy is going great. Everybody's very pleased about that. But the one area where you do begin to hear a little bit of nervousness is trade.
Like Wyoming senators, Cheney says she's a proud free trader. Still, she's giving the president room to negotiate. And she says most of the people she's talked to back home are, too.
So far, people really, the perspective is sort of, you know, we understand that this is an effort to get better trade deals, to help improve the situation. They are giving the president support still in terms of, let's let him run the negotiations out here.
Wyoming Senator John Barrasso serves on the Foreign Relations Committee. A couple months ago, they held a hearing on the potential impact of the tariff, or trade war. And he voiced his concerns about the potential impact of what many experts now say has become a full-blown tit-for-tat trade war.
You know, I'm concerned, just as everyone is, of the impact of the steel and aluminum tariffs on businesses and consumers.
Back in July, Barrasso and Wyoming senior Senator Mike Enzi were two of just 11 GOP senators to oppose a bill meant to signal to Trump that the Senate is watching his trade war and that they'll intervene if it escalates. Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey, a staunch conservative and reliable Trump ally, sponsored the bill. He says it's important because it states that the president can't use the national security designation, known as Section 232, to levy tariffs without the approval of Congress.
It puts senators on record either supporting or opposing the idea that Congress should have some say in invoking Section 232 tariffs. This would be new. And it's very important, I think, as a first step to doing something.
While Barrasso is worried about the impact steel tariffs may have on Wyoming's oil and gas industry, he's been pushing the administration to use that 232 authority to launch an investigation into uranium imports, which he argues are hurting Wyoming's large uranium industry.
Because what we've been seeing for years is that uranium producers owned by the government in Russia, in Kazakhstan, in Uzbekistan, they've unfairly flooded our American markets with cheap uranium to the point that today American producers fulfill less than 5% of our U.S. demand for uranium.
But a growing number of Republicans are getting restless with the trade war and want it wound down, not ratcheted up. Virginia Republican Congressman Rob Whitman has a large farming, seafood, and manufacturing base in his district. He says patience is starting to wear thin in his district.
Listen, I understand the president wanted to have maximum leverage in negotiating with China, but he's got to understand the long-term impact it'll have back here. So that means they've got to get something done. The longer it goes on, the bigger impact it has.
But Congresswoman Cheney says, at least for now, Wyoming's agriculture community has been largely shielded from the trade war. So she's remaining optimistic that Trump's hard-nosed tactics will end up working.
I understand what he's doing. I share the concern of my constituents that we want to make sure that we don't end up having more pain and frankly slowing down the economy. We've had tremendous economic recovery and we want to keep that going. So.
Still, Cheney says she and Wyoming business owners do have a breaking point.
They're not to the point yet where folks are saying, we don't like the policy. But they're sort of raising some cautionary notes about, this is the area where we're a little bit nervous.
Nervousness in the business community often means holding off on investments, which has most every Republican worried that the trade war will be felt by their voters soon. And they're hoping they don't feel it ahead of November's elections. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Two major Obama-era rules that aim to reduce methane from oil and gas operations are in the process of being weakened and rolled back. Many are worried about what it means for air quality. But in Wyoming, for one of the top 10 oil and gas producers in the country, it may not mean much. The state is looking at implementing its own similar guidance. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Dave Hole is a longtime resident of Pinedale, a town surrounded by a lot of oil and gas operations in western Wyoming. In 2008, Hull went cross-country skiing, and he noticed a heavy brown haze. I spoke to him last summer.
As I remember, I was in bed for a week or so with something like the flu. It felt like, but it didn't seem like the flu.
A local nurse told him it sounded like ozone poisoning. Through leaks, local oil and gas operations were emitting illegally high levels of ozone, a toxic gas caused by methane, which is 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. All that dirty air was causing coughing, nosebleeds, and chest pains among local residents. In 2013, Wyoming's Department of Environmental Quality put guidelines in place for stricter controls around those emissions, and the ozone was brought down. But that guidance only helped a small subset of western Wyoming. That changed with nationwide Obama-era methane rules when they were approved in 2016. They helped limit emissions everywhere in the country. The two rules required changes like semi-annual leak inspections, a limit to flaring, and low-leak valves, all to keep natural gas from escaping. But as of this September, both Obama-era methane rules are being changed dramatically. The Environmental Protection Agency's rule was weakened, and the Interior Department's was fully rolled back. John Goldstein is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
It's going to leave eastern Wyoming, where 80% of the drilling in Wyoming is currently happening, without the benefit of these measures.
And that's not just an issue for Wyoming. Over the next 7 years, rolling back these rules would cause about 1.7 million tons of additional methane emissions to be released, according to federal numbers. As these regulations go away, it may not be a total pollution free-for-all for oil and gas. Two states already have their own rules limiting the pollutant. And soon, Wyoming could join their ranks. The state's Department of Environmental Quality is looking to revise its guidance to include an important part of the EPA's rules, semi-annual inspections in search of invisible leaks to repair. That's a big deal.
The timing right now could not be better. It really is important for the state to get these finalized and have them in effect to protect Wyoming, Wyoming's air, but also Wyoming's taxpayers.
Wyoming's Department of Environmental Quality proposed three revisions to its rules guiding emission policies. The biggest change would be a statewide mandate for semi-annual leak inspections, a big change from only inspecting if an operation was reporting high emissions.
We're doing this because it's the right thing to do for Wyoming under our technical analysis of all the information we have.
That's Air Quality Division Administrator Nancy Veer. The rule would set a baseline for companies, requiring everyone to look twice a year for invisible leaks from tanks, pipelines, valves. Veer says the state has been reliably lowering emission levels for the past 20 years, even as production increases. Using this new inspection method is just another strategy to continue that trend, and one that doesn't break the bank for oil and gas.
Is this something that we can use to assure that we're meeting those health-based standards? And the answer was yes. This is how we're going to meet those.
Environmental Defense Fund's Goldstein says it would be good timing to see these requirements, given thousands of new wells are likely to come online around the state in the next decade, and would certainly prevent a lot of additional methane. It's a windy, bright day in Converse County, with oil rigs dotting the plains. Peter Wold stands on his most productive well pad, a 5-acre plot with two wells. He's president of World Energy Partners. Federal guidelines already have his company doing leak inspections, and he says he's fine letting the state keep that around.
I mean, one of the basic reasons is that we want to sell all this gas. We're not interested in having it vented.
Without leak inspection, natural gas could otherwise be slipping out of his hands, getting into the air releasing pollutants like methane, and not be sold. To avoid this, Wold does double the required leak inspections annually, has no bleed valves, and other high-end control equipment.
As you can see out here, we've gone beyond what those regulations require because we want to do it right.
Not every company goes this far. Leaks are ever-present in most operations. Nationally, the Environmental Defense Fund calculated over $2 billion worth of natural gas is lost on public lands from leaks, venting, and flaring. The appeal of federal regulations was that lost resources could be recouped with better technology. In other words, the cost would pay off. But the Trump administration's Interior Department didn't see it that way. They used a different equation and found it would cost industry more. And its own revised methane rule would even save companies about $1 billion over the next decade. And for Wold, he's happy to see the state take charge.
Wyoming has a history of being ahead of the feds. The emission regulations that are being proposed now are as good or better than what the EPA regulations are.
And state control is just what the Trump administration wanted in rolling back its rules, according to revisions. New Mexico and California attorneys general have already sued the federal government on rolling back the Interior Department methane rule. Wyoming DEQ's decision on revised state guidelines will be decided in November. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we will look at the impact of the Hathaway Scholarship and a conversation with the Constitution Party candidate for governor, Rex Rammel. This is Open Space. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Back in 2005, the Wyoming legislature set up the Hathaway Scholarship to help make higher education more accessible to Wyoming high school graduates. But data requested by Wyoming Public Radio indicates low-income students aren't reaping the same benefits from the program as their higher-income peers. Our education reporter, Tennessee Watson, takes a look.
Bailey Nowak welcomes me into a tiny office at the University of Wyoming.
Thanks.
Yes.
She coaches students on career skills like interviewing and resume writing. A UW student herself, it's one of two jobs she has to pay for school. She's also been running her own lawn care business since she was 12.
So I'm still mowing, even when it's September. Some of them are wanting me to mow till middle of October.
I first met this 20-year-old go-getter last spring when she was finishing up her associate's degree at Laramie County Community College. I was there working on a story about how more Wyoming college grads could help the state's economy. And Nowak was a shining example of a first-generation college student with big dreams. But her story is also one of missed opportunity. Nowak says she remembers an official presentation on the Hathaway Scholarship back in eighth grade, and she didn't really hear about it again in high school.
The reason I actually found out about the Hathaway is because I applied for LCCC and they asked me, well, do you have a Hathaway? And I said, yeah, maybe.
She scored a 23 on her ACT, well above the state average, but she was 2 points away from a full ride. She says she would have prepared for the test had she known that thousands of dollars were at stake.
Well, shouldn't you have told the juniors prior if it was higher ACT means higher scholarship money? I mean, that would have helped me out.
Nowak would have liked to have known that the Honors Hathaway was the only level that covered 100% of a student's need. The other three levels also provide a merit award, but only cover 25% of a student's need. Data from Wyoming's community colleges and UW indicates that low-income students aren't receiving the Honors Level Hathaway at the same rate as their higher-income peers, and neither are kids who are the first in their family to go to college.
Yeah, those numbers are quite interesting, to say the least.
That data doesn't surprise Nowak. Looking back, she says her peers from higher income families were more in the know.
Okay, prime example. My friend, her parents both swam for the University of Wyoming. They prepped her so hard for this ACT. She did nightly studies. She had to go into teachers and all this before her ACT. And I was like, well, why are you doing this? Well, you got to get a certain score. Well, how'd you know? And she goes, well, my parents.
Neither of Nowak's parents went to college, so she didn't have the advantage of a family with insider knowledge. Nowak's twin brother had even less information about the Hathaway.
When he went to go apply for the Hathaway, just in case he went to college, he actually didn't realize some of the standards, I guess, you needed.
He hadn't taken all of the required classes, and without the Hathaway, college felt out of reach. Since high school, he's been stuck in entry-level jobs. If Wyoming is serious about increasing the number of people with advanced degrees, Nowak says educators and policymakers need to make sure all kids have the information they need. Michael Wade from the University of Wyoming agrees.
If we want to increase, you know, the quality of life in our communities, if we want to grow the economy in Wyoming, right, we need to support all students.
Wade runs a program focused on supporting low-income and first-generation college students. He says we need to gather information that helps us understand these disparities.
And not just let it self-select into these students are doing well in Hathaway, these students aren't, these students are doing well in college and graduating, these students aren't, because I think those gaps, as we've seen, will not close. They'll stay the same or they'll continue to widen.
At UW, only 15% of honors-level recipients identified as first-generation college students. As the award amounts decrease, the percentage of first-gen students increases. The lowest award has 30%, twice as many. That means kids like Nowak aren't getting as much money. But state lawmakers aren't looking at those numbers. They're in control of how the Hathaway scholarship is evaluated, and nothing in their evaluation looks at how the scholarship is helping underserved populations get better access to higher education. UW trustee Michelle Sullivan says that's harmful to the state.
We as adults have a responsibility to recognize that every kid needs to be seen, and we all have a role to play, counselors, high schools, but also the community in making sure that we're supporting young people in a variety of ways.
Bailey Nowak says that would have made a huge difference for her brother and for her.
I wouldn't probably have to be working to afford to go to school because I would have had school paid for.
She says she'd rather be using that time to be studying and preparing to make a difference in her state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Rock Springs veterinarian Rex Rammel is running for governor as a member of the Constitution Party. Rammel, who is not a fan of Republican candidate Mark Gordon, decided to enter the race as a third-party candidate to give conservative voters another option. Rammel had considered running as a Republican, but initially decided to stay out of the race.
And as I looked at it, I could see that I was going to vote split with the conservatives. At that time, it was Taylor Haynes and Harriet Hageman. And I thought, if I stay in this race, all three of us are going to get beat. And so if I was going to proceed, I knew it couldn't be as a Republican. So I contacted the Constitution Party people, and they were more than happy to have me be their nominee. And I moved that direction, waiting to see who would win the Republican primary. I thought I'd let them beat each other up and and spend all their money. And if Gordon became the winner, then I would move forward. If any of the others won, I was going to back out. But Mark Gordon won it, just as I predicted. Not because he's that great of a candidate and he's barely a Republican, but because of the vote splitting scenario. And now he sits as a Republican nominee. But the irony of it all is that I'm the real Republican. I'm just on a different ticket.
So how do you see your difference, just using you against him as an example? What differences do you see between the two of you?
Well, the land issue is huge between us. I have been a strong voice for the transfer of management over the public lands for 10 years now. In fact, I'm the founder of the idea. And he, of course, he seems to be more than content having the federal government to control Wyoming, and I'm not. So that's number one. Number two, he's been the treasurer, and his mind has been on trying to make money on Wall Street with Wyoming's fairly vast investment portfolio, upwards of $20 billion. And I break away from him on that, too. I think that money would be better spent in Wyoming as business loans. So I'm an advocate of having a state bank like North Dakota does. North Dakota's got the number 3 economy over the last 10 years, and Wyoming's got the number 43, and with similar natural resources. And so I think what North Dakota's bank has done for their state has been tremendous, and I think it would work in Wyoming. We should bring all that money back, and we lend it out to new and existing businesses. It'll diversify the economy. It'll stimulate the economy for sure. You inject $10, $20 billion into the Wyoming economy, and it'll take care of itself.
We have candidate for Governor Rex Rammel joining us today. Let me talk a little bit about a couple of things you talked about and then take you another direction a little bit, maybe. But the Governor Meade right now is pushing this endow initiative, and as you talk about economic development, you talk about diversifying our economy. Do you like what you've seen out of Endow, or what direction would be better for the state?
You know, I think the Business Council for the last 20 years has been a failed model. Endow is just an extension of that in my mind. They're getting money appropriated in the millions to throw out into the communities to try to stimulate and diversify the economy. They're picking and choosing winners. And I just think it's the wrong way to go, and it has been for 20 years. I think the simple approach is to take our investment portfolio and wrap it back into the state and let the state bank administer those loans and let capitalism roll. It will take care of everything that the Business Council and Endow was supposed to do, only it will be using the free market system. And it will be effective. There's just no question in my mind. All the businesses need an economy needs to get going is capital, and we're sitting on it. We're not sitting on it. We're sending it to Wall Street and letting companies outside of Wyoming use it. Let's bring that money back to Wyoming, and then we don't need Endow.
Where would you like to see, as we talk about diversifying the economy, where would you like to see a lot of those loans go? What types of businesses are we lacking that you think you could get again going here in the state?
Everything. It wouldn't be up to me. I'd let capitalism and the free market decide. I think you'd see a lot of people. I was just talking to a guy the other day, and he said he sells some kind of a trailer that they market back in the Midwest. He said, if I had the money, I'd buy the company and move it to Wyoming. I mean, those are the sort of situations. I mean, you throw the money out there and say, hey, there's money for businesses. What do you want to do? And then just let the entrepreneurs decide which direction to go. It would take care of itself. It's a very simple economic principle, just to put the capital out there and keep the regulations low and let the free market system take over.
Rex, I would assume that you've been concerned about spending in state government as we look at what's been going on with a little bit of a shortfall the state's had in revenue and keeping things afloat on the state level. Where would you cut if you were to cut or maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe you're looking at taxes.
No, you certainly would be wrong about taxes. I'm the only guy that's pledged not to raise taxes. Mary advocates for taxes, Mary Throne, and Mark Gordon won't commit, which is basically, in my mind, that he would raise taxes if the legislature wanted him to. But I would veto any tax increase, no question about it. It's not necessary. And you're right, the state government is too big. We rank number 50 out of 50 states in size of government for our population. And we have for a long time. It's too big. It's inefficient. Now, where would I cut? I don't know right off the top, because what I would like to do is audit every department, every agency, and see why do we have so much government for our population. So go through a complete audit and then make decisions on how to get that thing under control, streamline it, keep our vital services, which of course we need, but there's got to be a lot of area where we could bring government back to where it should be. Now, my plan with the economic stimulus through the bank loans, it's just part of my revenue building strategy. The other strategy is to take over the public lands or management over the public lands, and I think conservatively there's $1 billion out there that could be that would then be the revenue for the state of Wyoming. Now, some of that money would have to be used to manage the land, put out fires. I'd like to get a logging industry going, things like that. But there would be some, I can't imagine it would take $1 billion to manage the public lands. So with the extra revenue that we had coming in, plus some modification of the size of government, I would like to see the property taxes decreased in this state. I think they're outrageous.
Rex Ramel, a pleasure. Thank you for taking time, and we will see you at a few debates coming up, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
All right. Thank you very much.
You can learn more about Rex Ramel at rexramel.com.
When we come back, an update on Wyoming's justice reform efforts and a story about toilets. This is Open Spaces.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Wyoming's prisons are overcrowded to the point that the state has had to ship some inmates out of state. An analysis of the state prison system shows that over 50% of those behind bars are there due to probation or parole violations. Lawmakers were told that they could save millions if they found a way to not return those people to prison and to help substance abusers at a young age. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
The legislature asked the Council of State Governments Justice Center to take a closer look at Wyoming's prison system. The project was overseen by Deputy Director Mark Pelka. He says there is a problem.
So Wyoming's prison population is projected to grow by about 200 people in the next 5 years. It's currently operating at full capacity.
And over half of that growth is due to people who violate probation or parole. Frequently, it's a substance abuse violation, but it can also be something as simple as missing a meeting with a probation or parole officer. Probation violators average about 19 months during their return stay in prison.
Because of the lengths of stay that people spend in prison on a probation parole revocation, it actually causes those people to occupy 30% of Wyoming's prison beds on any given day. And Wyoming spends $30 million incarcerating that population.
Pelka is suggesting changes in how probation and parole officials deal with those who are released from prison. And he'd like to see more resources directed towards those people. And if sanctions are needed, he'd prefer penalties that don't return people to prison. Albany County Attorney Peggy Trent says policies need to change so that people can be ordered into drug or alcohol treatment, and instead of the current approach of locking people back up.
We've got to take that option off the table and find all other alternative for drug offenses and how to treat them, but yet hold them accountable. The drug treatment court is an incredible programming piece.
Trent says that approach can keep people from reoffending.
The programming model allows for that daily, weekly interaction. You have a team working around you. We're teaching you life skills that you would have hoped that they had established when they were younger, and this helps them to get into treatment. So I would say we have not provided all of the tools that we have.
Trent says currently that option is voluntary, and so the law would need to be changed to make that mandatory. Another idea is more mental health treatment and increasing the number of people who are placed into adult community corrections programs, which normally have openings. But the problem is that not every community has those resources. Senator Tara Nethercott says prevention is important, but
how the state pays for those, I think, is very challenging. And I think that there has to be a stronger, I hate to use the term again because it's so trendy, but this the public-private partnership of understanding that some of those private nonprofits probably are going to need to see a stronger relationship with the state that provide those services such as mental health services, substance abuse-related services that can really get into those communities much more effectively.
Representatives of the Council of State Governments point out that if the state can keep people from both returning to prison and going there in the first place, it'll save millions of dollars that can be shifted into treatment. While there might be spending, Nethercott also says the Department of Corrections currently has the tools to make a number of changes internally. Lawmakers and corrections officials have wondered if adjustments in sentencing would make a difference, but Nethercott says if the department makes its own adjustments, that would also help.
That increasing prison population is, they need to look back at themselves for that rather than putting that on prosecutors or judges, which of course are also part of that complex situation.
Department Director Bob Lampert says they're already in the process of making some of those changes. The legislature's Joint Judiciary Committee will consider some bills at its November meeting to move this along. Sometimes justice reform efforts stall in the legislative process, but House Judiciary Committee Chairman Dan Kirkbride is optimistic.
We can hardly dismiss the possibilities of this, given our financial state, that every time we say no to this kind of thinking, we're just taking money out of our pocket with the other hand, and it's catching up with us.
CSG says justice reinvestment efforts are comprehensive and have worked well in other locations, and Mark Pelka is excited about what could happen in this state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Novelist Allison Hagee has been a professor at the University of Wyoming for 20 years, and her last three novels were set in a very realistic American West. But for her eighth novel, Scribe, Hagee ventures into new territory, a dystopia in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, an area where Hagee spent her childhood. I asked Hagee where the inspiration for such a radical new direction came from. Hagee says it all started on a visit home.
So I was driving through this landscape and I was thinking, wow, you know, these farms were once fabulous because there's a lot of water and you can grow lots of things there, enough for a family to live on. They are remnants of the barter culture, of the sort of really community-based kind of farming that you had all over the world and the nation. If I wasn't a blacksmith like my grandfather and great-grandfather, what would happen to someone like a writer? And that quickly led me to the truth that people who were literate in these communities did have a role. They could write letters, they could read texts, even if it was only the Bible. From that moment, Melody, my mind just went, it just caught fire, and I can't really tell you why. And from there, it wasn't very long before I had this woman living alone in this house who is part of this barter culture. There's been a civil war. And there's also been a pandemic, I would sort of say. I took the measles epidemics in that part of the world from about the 1880s and kind of souped them up. She has been in the business of offering kind of comprehensive services. She will memorize the letters and travel great distances and pronounce them to those who are to receive them. And when the book opens, she has stopped doing that kind of work because it's too hard and too dangerous. But the man who appears in her garden on the very first page of the novel wants her to travel and take a letter for him a great distance away. And so in the end, the book is a journey that the protagonist doesn't want to take but must take in order to fulfill the terms of a bargain.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your process as a writer, writing something that is more speculative.
I've been a dyed-in-the-wool American neorealist for 30 years, and I don't really know what happened this time. So I think of Scribe as a tale, old-fashioned and new-fashioned. Again, I relied on old ghost stories, the Jack tales from Appalachia, family stories, and an attempt to just kind of let my rational mind go on this one.
There's something also going on with this book that seems to really resonate with some things that are going on, you know, in our culture right now, with maybe tribalism, authoritarianism, some of those themes.
So again, some of that was conscious, some not. I will say this book was pretty much completely finished by late 2015. Some of the things that have happened in America in the last couple of years, they maybe seem to be echoed in the book, particularly the idea of an authoritarian or a fascist kind of leader. But I think what I really sensed was absolutely the tribalism. So Appalachia has been a very tribal kind of place for white settlers for a couple of hundred years. There's a lot of suspicion about outsiders. There's been a lot of us, them.
So even though the book is called Scribe,
on the cover in beautiful art by June Glasson, there's a woman holding an axe. Can you talk about that contrast?
It doesn't matter how digital our culture becomes. Storytelling remains very, very powerful to human beings, and it can be done in new ways now, but the ways, the tools, the rhetorical principles remain much the same. And we need stories to knit our communities together. Stories are what we use to agree, to live with one another, next to one another, and to share things. They are also the tools that are used to tear us apart. And so in choosing the cover art, I think I was very conscious about the fact that that language can seem not to be dangerous or destructive, but in fact it can be, and we see that in action every day around the world.
One thing I've noticed in both Boleto, your last novel, and this one, the density and the poetic lyricism of the writing is something that seems like it's evolving in your writing.
Language remains very important to me, and I think I work my way into my understanding of a character through the music of syllables and sentences. What I hope that I tried to do in Boleto, and again in Scribe, is to remain poetic, but also to strip things down more, to move away from adjectives and adverbs, and to try to come to storytelling more directly through nouns and verbs and maybe dialogue. I've been doing this for about 35 years now, and writing still remains a very musical occupation for me, very much so. The dogs circled the house all night, crying out, hunting. She knew they were calling to her, beckoning, working their churn. The world she lived in had become a gospel of disturbances, and the dogs wouldn't let her forget that. In the morning, before she had even gone to the spring house for milk, she saw a man waiting at the foot of her garden. It was how they did.
And where do you think it's leading next? Where is this propelling you?
Part of the answer is I don't really know. I've been noodling on something longer, and I don't know what it is. But the set of work that I've been doing after Scribe is very short, a series of very short stories that probably are sort of parable-like, but they're much more sharp-edged than Scribe. Next long book, I just can't tell. Scribe really threw me for a loop. And I think I'm just in a resting phase right now.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time to come and talk to me about this beautiful novel.
Oh, thank you so much for your great work and your wonderful questions.
To hear a reading from the book, plan to attend Scribe's book launch on Tuesday, October 2nd at 7 o'clock at Second Story Books in Laramie.
When visiting Yellowstone National Park or any parks in our region, there's a lot to consider. Will traffic be bad? What about the weather? Will I see any animals? But then something more basic. Will I be able to find a toilet that's clean, has toilet paper, and if I'm lucky, somewhere to wash my hands? As Maggie Mullen reports, you could be in for a surprise. A new toilet may be coming to a park near you, but be prepared for something different.
A busload of tourists just arrived at West Thumb Geyser Basin in Yellowstone. Their first stop, the bathroom, and they're in for a surprise, a squat toilet. Karen Consbrook is visiting from Oregon. I try to convince her to give it a go by telling her I just used it.
I used the squat toilet when I got here this morning and had to use some muscles I'm not used to in my legs, but it turned
out
okay.
That's the thing, you're young. It gets a little harder to start doing that the older you get. It's a little more difficult.
You do need strong quads. The squat toilet is essentially a short metal rectangle in the floor with a hole in the middle about 12 inches in diameter.
No, not really anybody used to that kind of thing.
That's Frank Ung. He's visiting the park today from Massachusetts, but he's originally from China.
I don't mind squat toilet, but I think you need much, much better ventilation.
Squat toilets are the norm across Asia, and that used to be the case in Europe and here as well. Vincent Ho is a gastroenterologist. He says it wasn't until about the early 19th century that seated toilets started showing up in London.
I think what we see now is across the developed world, the seated toilets have become universal, you could say.
But he says seated toilets are not so good for your health. Squatting is more natural and generally better for you. The problem is, he says, those health benefits aren't always enough to convince people.
Part of the drawback with the conventional squatting toilets is the fact that there's a bit of stigma around it. You know, I think that although it's popular in many other countries in the Western world, it doesn't appear to be popular. It's not a desirable kind of posture to be in.
But squat toilets could be making a comeback in the Western world, at least online. A YouTube ad involving a unicorn, an English knight, and psychedelic soft serve ice cream, don't ask, is making the rounds.
And now there's a product that lets you squat in your own home. Introducing the Squatty Potty.
It's a bathroom stool that converts a sitting toilet into a squatting one. As of now, the video has over 34 million hits. And this brings us back to Yellowstone National Park. The park's decision to go full-on squat toilets wasn't in response to online marketing ads like this one or even health. They had a toilet problem.
That prompted us to act.
That's Yellowstone's Morgan Worthen. She says visitors were complaining about the condition of restrooms.
The broken toilets were caused by people that were using the toilets differently than we as U.S. citizens would be accustomed to.
Differently, as in squatting on top of toilets instead of sitting on them. The result, broken seats and some really gross conditions.
The squat toilets, they have made a difference.
It costs around $1,000 to convert a Western toilet to a squat one. But Worthen says that's a pretty good deal, considering Yellowstone hasn't seen many broken toilet seats since they added the squat option. Down the road in downtown Jackson, Teton County Parks Manager Andy Erskine tells me they're considering this route as well. He says toilet misunderstandings made their way to his town this summer.
We've just seen such a tremendous increase in the tour bus business to Jackson, which has a lot of Asian visitors coming with it.
But Teton County isn't going straight to the squat toilet option. It's starting with directions on how to use a Western toilet.
The stickers that we have put up now are in Japanese, Taiwanese, and Mandarin, which we think kind of covers all the bases, as well as in English, with some pictures and some diagrams on how to properly do things.
And Erskine says they seem to be working.
Once we got those up, literally within days, we started to see a real kind of rectification of the problem.
Teton County hasn't ruled out installing squat toilets in the future, but Erskine says if this current solution isn't broke, why fix it? For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll wrap up the program. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The Worlds of Music program has brought folk music traditions and musicians from around the world to Wyoming for 23 years. The nonprofit's next big program is a four-day event in Buffalo this October, featuring the music of Quebec. Writer and musician David Romvet is the group's founder. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard about how making music can bring...
I'm very clearly committed to the idea that through music and the diversity of our experience through music, we can come to know one another in many ways we might otherwise not. And so my experience led me to think maybe this could happen for other people too if they had a chance to meet with musicians from around the world, try to play music from around the world. So there's the music part, but then there's a social part too. It's very much about how we build community. We try to provide programs that give people the opportunity to actually be music makers. And in addition to these events where we bring musicians from around the world into Wyoming, we also have an ongoing program centered in Buffalo, and that's to run an ongoing community steel drum program playing Trinidadian-style pan music. And that, of course, gives people, often many who've never played music in their lives, have maybe dreamt of playing music all their lives, but somehow haven't been able to, a chance to participate. And I've been amazed at how many people have had some terrible experience of music making. A very common one people will tell us is when they were in elementary school, their band teacher or choir teacher told them, just hold the horn to your mouth, but don't actually play. Or just open your mouth and move it, but don't actually sing. And they got traumatized by being told they couldn't be musicians. So this has been a great opportunity for many people.
What do you think music uniquely says about different cultures around the world?
To me, one of the most interesting things how music sounds can't be separated from meanings people attribute to them. So that we might hear something given our cultural background and think it transmits to us a certain emotion that will be completely different than the emotion transmitted to a person from that culture. It's really amazing. So there's some famous stories about this, like the first Balinese gamelan musicians. This is a big metal orchestral form, and they first played in the West at a Paris exposition in the 19th century during a time when the John Philip Sousa brass band music was very popular in the U.S., and the organizers in France took these Asian musicians to hear the Sousa band that was there, and afterwards said, "What do you think? Did you like it?" And they said, "Oh my God, it was beautiful. We loved that music, but man, we have never heard such sad music." And of course, for people from this culture, it's pretty shocking to think of da 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 as deeply sad music. And there are many examples of that kind of thing.
How do you find the visiting musicians that come to Wyoming for these Worlds of Music programs?
Well, we found them in a million ways. As a musician myself, I have worked for many years at various adult summer music camps. These are residential programs that bring often the very musics maybe are at risk. And part of the reason these camps have been created over the last 50 years is because people have felt there are risks for certain cultures and musics. So I've worked at these camps, and often I will encounter a music there that I then can approach that person. It's really great because I have the chance to get to know the person and know how they would interact in community, if they could work with children and adults as a teacher, as in addition to being a performer. So that's one way. Another way is through word of mouth with other friends who are musicians around the world. A third way is through American government programs that exist to bring diverse musics to the U.S. The American State Department, for example, has a program of bringing visiting musicians to the U.S. And then another way is simply musics I know about. I start writing to places and asking about people and then contacting people. I've found that for the programs we do, it's super important that people really have a sense of where they're coming and what it is we want them to do, that it's not just showing up somewhere and giving a show, that it really is about interacting with people and creating community through music.
Can you tell me about the upcoming program for World of Music?
Yes, we have done over the last several years a bunch of really big programs. By that I mean they last a long time residentially, working in schools. They have big bands. And so with this one, we decided to try to do something a little simpler. So we've brought two musicians, Kevin Carr and Josie Mendelson. Kevin Carr is a very widely respected fiddler, bagpiper, and penny whistle player. Josie Mendelson, who's coming with Kevin, piano player, wonderful piano player, but also was a founding member of a bluegrass band called the Good Old Persons. The Good Old Persons was one of the very first all-women bluegrass bands. Both Kevin and Josie play in a Quebec-style band. We're bringing them here specifically to play Quebecois music, which is a fiddle, button, accordion, piano-based tradition historically.
What does Quebecois music, you mentioned the instruments, but what does it sound like?
Well, let's see. If people had ever heard Irish traditional music on the fiddle and the button accordion and the flute, they would have some little sense of Quebecois music. Quebec music, of course, is a music that was made from the crossing of the original French immigrants to eastern Canada with later arriving English, Scottish, Irish musicians. So those musics crossed, and I always think of Quebec music as the only southern music played in the far north.
Worlds of Music will host public workshops, performances, and talks in Buffalo October 10th through 13th. David Rombett, thank you so much for sharing about the Worlds of Music program.
Thank you.
communities together.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces, and don't forget to support local news coverage with your pledge of support here at WyomingPublicMedia.org. We cannot bring this show or any of our high-quality local news coverage without support from people like you.
If you missed any part of this show or want to hear a segment again, you can also find it on our website. Just click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio.